Hi,
Hi,
Josh.
Josh. Hey, Dylan, how are you?
Doing well, thanks. So I'm Dylan Matthews. I'm a reporter at the Want Blog division at Washington Post, and you are?
I'm Josh Barrow. I'm the lead blogger for the ticker at Bloomberg View.
Awesome, and we're going to be talking about taxes today, mostly, it seems.
Very exciting.
Very gripping stuff, gripping stuff.
Yes. Keep watching.
Gets better from there. So the big sort of report of the week is the Tax Policy Center is out with an analysis of Mitt Romney's tax plan, and sort of the headline result is if you make it revenue neutral by financing Romney's proposed cuts and income rates with cuts to tax expenditures, credits, deductions, and such, that the overall result is that 95% taxpayers, according to the TPC, get a substantial, well, not huge, but a real tax hike, and the top 5% see a decline.
Right.
And it was interesting there. I'd be interested in as a sort of think tanker who's written reports on this, what your take on the methodology is, since the overall since one of the problems with Romney's initial proposal was that it proposed a rate cuts and was clear on what those would be, and proposed sort of cutting the corporate income tax as well, and then said sort of as is traditional. Will fund
Base
this.
expansion to come,
Right,
basically.
exactly. Right.
Well, so I think a couple of things about the TPC methodology. One is I think they did basically what they could do with the available information. The Romney plan isn't really a plan. It's this, there's this, as you say, there's this framework on tax rates, but it's completely unclear as to what the tax base expansion would look like. So what they did was they basically took the most progressive possible version of Romney's proposal, where basically you get rid of all the tax preferences that benefit people making over $250,000 a year. And then once you've done that, you keep going down the income brackets, eliminating preferences over and over again until you've generated enough revenue to offset all the rate cuts he did. So I think, doing the thought experiment goes, I think TPC took the right approach to that. One quibble I have with them is that for some reason what they do is they're saying that Romney's plan is revenue neutral compared to a current policy baseline. And so that means, tax policy as exists in 2011 continues into the future, with the exception of the or excuse me, as in 2012 continues into the future, with the exception of the payroll tax cut, which is basically everyone agreed was supposed to be temporary. The one weird thing, though, is that they treat the Affordable Care Act as current policy, and they treat the tax increases that are supposed to come into effect with that in 2014 as part of the current policy baseline. So when Romney repeals those tax increases, they're saying he has to make up that two things. One, he has to make up that revenue. So that means that that's, more revenue they have to come up with by expanding the base. And the other thing is the tax provisions in the Affordable Care Act were very progressive. The tax increases fell almost entirely on people with very high incomes. So naturally, if you say, well, we're not going to implement those, then that makes the tax code less progressive than it otherwise would have been. They say in the report that the numbers are basically the same if you exclude that from the current policy baseline, just because those tax increases are not that large relative to the tax changes that Romney is doing. But I'd like to see those numbers without that, because I think it is incorrect to include that in a current policy baseline. The Affordable Care Act is not current policy. It's policy that will come in 2014. But aside from that, I think their methodology was basically correct and was what you could do, given the very limited information that Romney's given about his tax plan. The other thing I'd note is that this assumption of revenue neutrality is not. It's not clear that Romney's plan is supposed to be revenue neutral. The campaign has sent mixed signals on that. There's actually a Glenn Hubbard op-ed today in the Wall Street Journal that says the plan will be revenue neutral, but the way that Romney talks about it in speeches and in the blog post that announced the plan back in February is that the plan will not grow the deficit because he will expand the tax base, the economy will grow faster, and he'll cut spending. So that's saying that the plan will be deficit neutral, but it could avoid growing the deficit by cutting on the spending side. Now, TPC says correctly that spending cuts will tend to be more regressive than eliminations of tax preferences, but A, that wouldn't necessarily have to be true depending on what you cut.
Right.
And depending on what you assume about who benefits from government spending. I mean, for example, if you cut military spending,
exactly.
How do you allocate the benefit of excess spending on the military? Now, Romney has said he will grow spending on the military, so that's not on the table. I think in practice it is extremely likely to be true that to the extent Mitt Romney cuts spending, he will do so in a regressive way.
Right.
But it's a more complicated question to ask. I also think what the Romney people would say is that government spending on entitlements doesn't benefit the poor as much as it looks like it does on paper because it
right.
creates a culture of dependency or slows the economy or what have you. So I think they would argue with that point, but I think they probably won't argue with the point because I don't think they really want to get into the question of whether the plan is revenue neutral or not.
Right, right. Like, it seems much more likely that if something like this is passed, it would not be with an assumption of revenue neutrality and probably wouldn't be paired with spending cuts, but that sort of CBO would score it as increasing the deficit. Sort of
mm-hmm.
The presumably if Romney's elected, there will be a Republican majority in both houses, since sort of the chances of a Republican Senate majority are already pretty high. And so I assume they would just pass it regardless. So
right,
yeah,
and they might even just say the CBO score is wrong.
Right. As they're wont to do. And that's the tricky thing with this is that you have to make all these sort of political assumptions and some of them that we're willing to make, like that Romney's cuts are going to be to things like SNAP or sort of domestic discretionary spending, which are more regressive, and then other ones like, I mean, I think if Romney's president, you can very easily repeal all those tax cuts through reconciliation, and I assume even if they can't repeal, even if Harry Reid aggressively filibusters repeal of the non-reconciliation dealable with elements of the Affordable Care Act, that sort of one of the first things they're going to do is try to get rid of the excise tax and the Medicare add-on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think a full repeal, even of all the stuff that you can repeal through reconciliation, is a tougher political act than the Republicans are making it sound like, because
right.
you can keep, you know, you can take the most popular parts of the bill and say, well, let's strip out the repeal of the provision that allows young adults to stay on their parents' health plans until they're 26, and let's strip out the pre-existing condition provisions and so forth. And so I think you're right that, you know, they can repeal all the tax provisions, and they probably would do that.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's an open question of, I mean, in reconciliation, they could repeal all the insurance tax credits, since the insurance subsidies are all implemented through the tax code. And even if they weren't sort of in spending, you can do that through reconciliation. And then sort of it puts the Democrats in an uncomfortable position where if you have a guaranteed issue and community rating, and so sort of insurers have to give everyone care and can't discriminate on the basis of pre-existing conditions, the result is going to be the premiums are going to skyrocket. And without subsidies, sort of that's an outcome that no one likes. And so, I mean,
mm-hmm.
Harry Reid is going to be in this very weird situation where sort of he wants to hold on to this part of his legacy, but also sort of if it's gutted, it could be worse than full repeal.
Well, but I think, you know, I think that can be a surprisingly politically sustainable condition where you've had this death spiral and no one can buy insurance, because that's the reality we live right now in New York State. New York has guaranteed
right.
issue and has full First community state. Rating. Right. It's even more extreme than in the federal bill. You can't rate based on age at all in New York State. And so I'm a contractor right now, and I was pricing out individual health insurance plans, and the regular Blue Cross individual plan that I could buy here in New York costs about $1,350 a month for an individual plan.
Cool.
And that's, you know, there's no process to go through to get that price, because that's the price for everybody, because we have complete full community rating. I don't have to tell them anything about my health condition or my age or even my sex or anything like that. I'm, you know, it's right. Just, you know, $15,000 a year if I want that health plan. No, I can, there are other options that are basically just catastrophic coverage that you can get for about $450 a month. That's through other insurers. But again, that's, you know, that's purely just insurance. It's actually, unless I got hit by a bus or something, I wouldn't actually be making any claims. So, you know, in practice for me, I'm able to stay on COBRA, at a, you know, merely exorbitant rather than completely egregiously exorbitant price. But, you know, I bring this up just because this has been the case in New York for as long as I've been aware of the situation. Less than 0.1% of residents of New York State have insurance bought through the individual market.
Right.
And yet we haven't either repealed guaranteed issue and community rating or replace them with a system that would be less extreme and would drive prices up less. But we also haven't, you know, there are subsidies for people with lower and middle incomes, but, you know, for people, you know, with reasonably well-paying jobs, there's no way to get any sort of subsidy on that. Your option is just, you know, pay $15,000 for the plan or obtain insurance through an employer.
Right. Or rough it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
But we're a little far
afield. Yeah, we are.
My point is just basically, I don't think it's impossible for Republicans and Democrats to arrive at some sort of gridlock that results in our health insurance system being way more screwed up than it is already, and pointing the finger at each other but not fixing it.
Right. So I guess the since we're already talking about what the next Congress will do, this is sort of, well, one question that the Romney plan raises is regardless of which one wins, what sort of shape tax reform is going to take, since there's a lot of sort of stated interest in this, that you hear a lot of interest, especially in rate cutting, base broadening stuff for the corporate tax. It seems like there, like the main proposal that I've seen for a similar approach in the personal income tax was the Wyden Coates bill, which doesn't actually cut rates that much. the top rate, I believe, is still 35%.
Mm-hmm. Is that a rehash of what was the Wyden Gregg bill?
Very much so. I believe it's identical. Okay. But Coates sort of stepped up and was the Republican co-sponsor. But it's funny that there seems to be little enthusiasm for more drastic, like in the 90s and to some extent during the Bush administration, sort of the in-vogue reform was moving away from taxing income toward taxing consumption. And that's one area where, like, I think both sides have some broad agreement. It's politically difficult for the Democrats now, since sort of exempting investment income doesn't make a lot of people happy.
Right.
But it really seems like that's died down as an interest.
Well, I think that was always inevitable once you started sketching out the numbers from it, because Democrats want to be able to demagogue investment income and complain about people like Mitt Romney paying, you know, 13% tax. I mean, if you know, under a consumption tax system, Romney's tax rate on his income would be considerably less than it is now, because presumably right. Romney is consuming only a small percentage of his income. So I can't imagine Democrats going for that. Both because I think, you know, on an actual ideological level, they don't want to give people like Mitt Romney a tax cut. And then they also, on a political level, want to be able to complain about it. Where I think the stumbling block is for Republicans is that because the base of a consumption tax is smaller than the base of an income tax, you need higher rates. And in order to maintain right. progressivity, you really need much higher rates at the top. And so I think once you start looking at what those rates have to be, Republicans will balk because the rate is too high. Or if they structure it with rates they consider acceptable at the top, then it will be a drastically more regressive tax system than the one we have today. So I think that that's why it's not possible to achieve bipartisan agreement on that. I'd love to see something like what the Bradford X tax, where you just have
right.
A tax on individual consumption, and then you have a tax on what basically looks like a VAT, but businesses also deduct wages paid in addition to
Right.
deducting cost of goods sold. That, you know, is a system that allows for progressivity, avoids double taxation, would be considerably more economically efficient, but I think it doesn't provide what either party is looking for politically. And so I don't, I think I disagree that there was ever a lot of momentum behind consumption taxation in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people were, a lot of academics were talking about it. Maybe some politicians were talking about it in a fairly abstract way, but I think there's a reason we got the tax reforms that we did, where we cut capital gains taxes in the 90s, which is an attempt to encourage investment without actually going fully to a consumption tax system. And then when the Republicans came in, I think it's, you know, it's fairly obvious why what they did was cut ordinary income rates and cut capital income rates.
Right, right. And I mean, there's been some revival of academic interest in that. I don't know if you saw Alan Viard's book on the X tax that just came out.
I haven't seen it, no.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, it's the same X tax as always. Just for people less engrossed in this, the idea with the X tax is, so a normal value added tax is levied on each stage of things that businesses buy. That sort of as suppliers sell to wholesalers sell, and so each expense at each stage is taxed. And so one of the expenses is labor, obviously. And so what the X tax does is exempt that expense and then sort of tax it in the form of a payroll tax later.
Right.
And so it's a way to do a VAT without while maintaining progressivity, because you can have a progressive payroll tax. And it's also much easier to administer than an income tax, since payroll taxes are really easy to administer. VATs are easier to administer.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Democrats don't like the idea of taxing wages only, and Republicans have become fairly apoplectic about the idea of a European-style VAT, that the sort of money machine critique gets brought up a fair bit.
Right.
It's just too easy to raise rates. I think I agree that there's very little chance of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think we're going to see tax reform until we've had the fiscal adjustment that shrinks the long-term budget gap, because I think that it's just too easy for the parties to have these symbolic fights, which is why you have these votes over and over again on letting the Bush tax cuts expire on the wealthy. They don't see a lot of political value in doing actual tax reform. When there will be political value in it is when there is a tax increase, and people are upset about that. And the idea will be that, you know, well, we need this as a way to ease the economic pain that comes from the big tax increase we just had. So I don't think that fiscal adjustment is coming until probably after the 2014 elections.
Mm-hmm.
But when that happens, I think it's possible that we will see some sort of tax reform associated with it. But the other thing is we got rid of a lot of the low-hanging fruit in the 1986 tax reform. If you want to expand the tax base now, you have to go after things that are really politically popular, things like the mortgage interest deduction, the tax exclusion for health care, which, by the way, is way bigger than the mortgage interest deduction. It's the granddaddy of all of these. And so I think the health care one might in the end be the most vulnerable. Because we also have health policy that's in flux, and so you can do changes to tax policy and a change to health policy that makes the tax exclusion less necessary.
Right.
Maybe if we have the sort of stalemate that we talked about with part but not all of the Affordable Care Act having gone away and the healthcare system becoming increasingly dysfunctional as a result of that, it'll be possible to tie up all these things together in one reform package. But that's, you know, when you add together all the tax preferences for healthcare between exemption from the income tax, exemption from the payroll tax, and then, you know, these sundry other deductions for health
right.
savings accounts, you're looking at, I believe it's at $300 billion a year.
I think that's the JCT figure, yeah.
Yeah, which is enormous.
Yeah, it's huge.
That's like a third of the federal budget deficit.
Right. And I mean, the excise tax sort of gets at this and sort of indicates that sort of it's politically vulnerable, but I believe the revenue from that is nowhere close to $300 billion.
Well, the funny thing with the excise tax, and this is the tax in Obamacare that basically if you have a Cadillac health plan, you have to pay a tax on the extent the premium exceeds some amount. But this was really controversial when the law was getting put together, and it was fought particularly by a lot of public employee unions, which tend to be the people who actually have these Cadillac health plans.
Right.
And so what they kept doing was increasing the cap and I believe delaying the implementation. So that basically the universe of plans that would actually be subject to the tax just kept getting smaller and smaller. Now the idea is the cap, and do you remember what I think it was something like $18,000 they ended up settling on, that's enormous. I mean, that's even more expensive than that crazy expensive health plan I was talking about in New York State that I was looking at buying. So basically almost nobody's going to get hit with this thing in the first year that it's effective, which is not until 2018.
You really don't like paying copays when you prick your finger, it's going to be tough for you. But
almost nobody has those health plans, and even a lot of governments have been getting rid of these plans because state and local governments are under strain. So there are probably fewer of these plans out there now than were out there in 2009 when the bill was being negotiated.
Right.
But the way it's structured is that cap only grows by the rate of inflation. So if healthcare inflation continues to outpace it, over time more and more plans should become subject to the tax. And the idea is hopefully if the thing gets left undisturbed politically by 2050, basically everybody's health plan is subject to this tax. And it's the tax is a 35% tax, which is basically designed to offset the value of the income and payroll tax exclusions that you get on the health plan in the first place. So theoretically left undisturbed, it could effectively get rid of the healthcare, health insurance tax exclusion over time. Now in practice, these tax policies having to do with healthcare, Congress has a tendency to fix them. And so I think it's possible that, the Cadillac tax either will get repealed at some point or, more likely they will just keep raising and raising the ceiling so that it just doesn't affect that many health plans. But if it's left in place, it could be an effective cost control measure.
Right.
And could raise revenue.
Right. And I think the place where I'm seeing more movement on the mortgage deduction, and there's obviously some sort of, and after Fannie and Freddie were bailed out, there's been sort of a lot of soul searching about what the role of the federal government should be in housing. But the policy reaction that I'm seeing, I don't know if you saw the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities put out a renter's tax credit proposal.
For real or as a like a Jonathan Swift modest proposal kind of thing?
For real. For serious for real.
Oh, God. It's funny, that has to be like the only tax cut CBPP has ever endorsed. And it's like the dumbest. I mean, I'm a renter. I guess it would be nice to get a tax credit, but
right. I mean, I'm a renter too. I mean, I think the case for it is sort of the case for having a separate tax treatment of homeowners and renters is remarkably weak, and sort of encourages bubbles like the one in the 2000s. But you can solve that one of two ways. You can solve it through sort of excluding everything, or you can solve it by excluding nothing and just sort of making the tax code neutral that way.
They're not equivalent, though, and it's not just because one raises more revenue than the other. I mean, the argument for treating homeowners with a preference to renters is very weak, but the argument for having tax preferences for housing in general is also weak. So if you have a mortgage deduction and you have a renter credit, it's not as though you had no housing tax policy at all. It's that you have this big tax subsidy for housing, whether you rent it or buy it.
Right.
And so it's not distorting between renting and owning anymore, but it's distorting towards spending more money on housing and less money on everything else. So it would be distinctly preferable to get rid of the preference for homeowners rather than to add one for renters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, both in that regard and sort of the obvious revenue implications. Yeah, it's
right.
But I think that you're right that it's harder than the health deduction, just since it's very easy to demagogue that people want to make your mortgages more expensive
and our housing market is not as broken as our healthcare market, which is saying something about the healthcare market.
Yeah, it's pretty ugly out there.
So
I guess do you want to pivot from everybody's taxes to Mitt Romney's taxes?
Sure.
So, I think so. The latest thing today is Harry Reid has reiterated his allegation that Mitt has paid no taxes, and Eric Fernstrom, Romney's advisor, his response was, "Have you no sense of decency?" Which is a weird McCarthy allusion to be bringing into this, but. It is one of those. It's a nice bit of political jujitsu in that it's sort of
Yeah.
that if you're gonna act outraged, there's a very easy way to dispel this idea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wrote something about this earlier this week. Basically, you know, if Mitt's not releasing his tax returns, it's because he thinks that whatever is in them is more damaging than whatever people imagine to be in them. And the strategy that Democrats will then take on this is try to turn up the dial on that imagination and imagine worse and worse things. And, you know, Reid can say, well, I'm just asking questions. I'm not, you know, I don't know what's in his tax returns, but he does, and he can answer these questions
Okay.
by releasing them. So it's, you know, it's a cute game. I thought the way Reid put it was
Oh my gosh.
pretty laughable, where he
Oh
was like,
no.
well, an investor of Mitt
Okay.
Romney's told me that he didn't pay any taxes for 10 years.
Sure.
You know, if I
I
were
feel
Mitt
like that's
Romney
like
and I were and I had a zero tax liability, the last thing I would be doing is blabbing to the investors in Bain Capital Funds
Oh, yeah.
about the
Right.
fact that I paid no income taxes.
Yeah.
That I
Mitt
lost
Romney's a
all
lot
this
of
money
things,
on
but
their investments.
Yeah.
Right. It's like Mitt Romney is not a guy who brags about, you know, what his tax bill is. I think, you
Right.
know, the part of all this is I think he does sort of resent
Yeah.
having to make so much financial disclosure, and I think that's consistent with him not
Yeah, because
making
the wisdom
frivolous
comes.
financial disclosures to people in his professional circle. So
Right.
whether or not Reid is
Okay.
right in this guess, and I strongly suspect
Awesome.
he is not, and that Romney did in fact pay taxes every year, certainly his story about how he would know that Romney's
But you're
paying no
getting.
taxes is complete nonsense.
Right.
Ready now.
And I mean,
Yeah.
the other reason he wouldn't blab to investors is, I mean, so one, he had sort of personality difference, and the other is that sort of the two ways in which he would have reduced his tax liability to zero
Okay.
is extremely aggressive evasion or like losing a lot of money.
Right.
And like it doesn't inspire confidence in your
No.
investors.
No.
You're going around bragging about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, Michael Gratz, who's a very sharp tax policy guy at Yale Law, has had an interesting op-ed a few days
Yes. Are
ago,
you going to
going
be
into
reading
sort
that?
of
Yes.
some weird aspects of Romney's IRA, and trying to explain the ways that this return his returns could have been much lower.
Right.
Basically, sort of, yeah, go ahead.
The gist of the Gratz piece, as I read it, is basically that, you know, when you contribute an asset to your IRA that's not something simple
Yeah.
like cash, you have to come up with a valuation of it. And so
Yes,
Romney
you
would have
guys
been
are lovely.
contributing interests in companies that he owned that were
Yeah,
not liquid. And
guys,
so
you know
Gratz
what
is
I'm
basically suggesting that he understated the
That we
value,
should
or
get
that he
them.
may have understated the value of those contributions in a way
Are
that
you
he knew
going
was
to say this?
unlikely to be caught by the IRS, but that allowed him to get around the IRA rules and get around also separately some
Yes.
gift
Well,
tax
he can't be
rules
able to start his
and,
own
you know,
firm.
gain a tax
Yes.
preference on more
That
of his
was
assets than he
true.
should have been able to.
Right.
Yes, for sure.
And yeah, I think sort of Gratz's
Well,
takeaway
enjoy your
call
long
is
weekend. I'm
not
sure you
release
will.
all your tax returns, but sort of release your gift
Okay,
tax
thanks.
returns, show us you weren't doing this.
Right.
Release a few income tax returns to sort of confirm it. But yeah, I mean, it's the sort of I mean, it's a hard thing to, as long as he doesn't do anything illegal, like I think most people would have done the same thing under the current situation. But I think sort of wanting to do everything you can to make your taxes sort of lower is something that voters can relate to. But most people don't
What?
can't transfer parts
No
of
way.
companies. And
Right.
so like
Why would they say
I think it's similar to
that?
the McCain House in Broglio
Right.
in 2008, in that it's not that people didn't know McCain
But
was rich. It was
what?
just that this was an exceptionally
No, that's
vivid
not true. That
illustration of how his
actually
life
is
was different
not
because he was
true.
rich.
That's
And
not
that the
true.
tax returns for some of the things he
Read this
did
again.
will be
What
damaging,
the
not that he was
bleep?
trying to reduce his tax burden, but
Oh,
that
dear.
sort of he can do a lot more exotic things to reduce his tax burden than most people.
I'm not sure I buy that. I mean, people know that Mitt Romney is not just rich, but really, really rich, and that he, you know, was an investor guy with lots of complicated finances. I think that, you know, to the extent people object to that, that's baked in the cake. I think the problem would be if he was doing something whose legality is questionable.
Right.
I don't think what matters is that it's exotic. I think that what matters is, you know, what Gratz is alleging that Romney may have broken the law.
Right, right.
And he's saying that, you know, a lot of people break these laws. Gratz doesn't seem especially furious about it, but but what he's suggesting is that there, you know, it's not that Romney did clever but legal things that aren't available to most people to reduce their tax burden. Gratz is suggesting that Romney underpaid his taxes in a way that he thought wouldn't get him caught. And so I think, you know, if that was true, that would be damaging on its substantive level, not because it reminds people that Romney is wealthy.
Right.
I'm skeptical. I mean, Gratz knows more about this stuff than I do, but a lot of people, there are a lot of enormous IRA and 401k accounts out there because of things that got contributed when they were in low value and then their value exploded. You have people from, you know, who were employees at Google early on who had Google in their 401ks before the IPO, who now have, you know, the 7+ figure 401ks. I met with some hedge fund guys a couple of years ago when there was the part of the expiration of the Bush tax cuts was that it suddenly became possible to do conversions of as much of a regular IRA as you wanted into a Roth IRA.
Right.
There was no cap on how much the balance could be or how much your income could be. And so you were going to get a bunch of people who had, you know, 7- and 8-figure IRAs due to their time at Google doing a one-time conversion and paying a few million dollars in income tax. This is, you know, this isn't completely unique to Mitt Romney.
Right.
That said, you know, it's the being at Bain Capital is not quite like being at Google. It's the percentage appreciation he would have to have achieved to get so much money in his IRA is very, very impressive. But it doesn't seem outlandish to me that he could have done so in a legal way because he had access to a lot of these very early investments, some of which did very well.
Right, right. And I guess the other distinction that the Democrats would want to draw from the Google stuff is just sort of the general attacks they've been making on private equity generally. But that's not a new line of
no.
That's sort of well-trod territory at this point.
Right.
That seems right. I don't know. I mean, Mitt Romney cheated on his taxes is a pretty solid soundbite, but I actually don't know how damaging, like, that.
Oh, I think that would be hugely damaging.
You do? Okay.
I think the. Yeah, because it's different. Because people would assume that whatever was done on purpose. I mean, Tim Geithner just barely survived his thing by sort of claiming, you know, "Oops, I forgot that I was supposed to pay tax on that thing." But it was with Geithner, we were talking about a few thousand dollars, and we were talking about a guy who was doing his own taxes, not hiring.
Right, and a guy who was working at the IMF and could say, I was doing this for the public good, I think people are more sympathetic to that.
Right, and they weren't that sympathetic to it.
It took
a lot of the president's political capital to get Geithner through. I think it would be much more damaging to Mitt Romney, who would not be given the benefit of the doubt on it.
And it totally sunk Daschle, for one thing.
It sunk Daschle, and it also sunk this woman, I forget her name, but she was supposed to be like the productivity czar. And she had something where she had a housekeeper at her house in the District of Columbia, and she forgot to pay unemployment insurance tax. It was literally over a matter of about $300.
Yeah, the nanny things are ridiculous.
But the thing was that because the Geithner had this tax problem, that they couldn't let anybody else have had a tax problem. So I think, you know, in general, there's actually a fairly low level of tolerance for this sort of thing. So, but I think what's more likely is that there's stuff in Romney's returns that isn't obviously illegal in the way that the stuff Gratz is laying out would be if we actually got to look at it, but that are, you know, just things that are of questionable aggressiveness. And there are a lot of things that can be done on a tax return that tax lawyers will argue about whether it's allowed or not. And I think that's a fight that Romney doesn't want to get into. I think there's something in there that I think he can offer a legal defense of, but would prefer not to have to.
Right.
That's my guess anyway.
No, that seems right. You want to pivot to post office now?
Sure.
This is not a great segue, but sure.
Yeah. So I have a piece this morning about. I mean, I think we all saw yesterday the post office announced that it's going to miss a $5.5 billion payment that legally it's supposed to make into its trust fund for retiree health benefits.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that I think this issue has been really widely misunderstood, and also there are really two separate financial problems at the post office that get conflated with each other. One is this retiree health benefits issue where, you know, for decades the post office promised benefits to its employees when they retired. It didn't set aside any money for it. Just when they retired, it would start cutting checks to pay for their health care. And so it built up this enormous liability that's now in the neighborhood of $90 billion, basically health benefits that workers and retirees have earned but have not yet claimed because they have more years of retirement ahead of them. And so in 2006, Congress decided, okay, well, we're going to start making the post office fund this liability. And not only that, we're going to make them fund it really aggressively. We're going to give them 10 years to get it from unfunded to fully funded. And the problem is the post office basically doesn't have any cash. And this is the post office's second big financial problem, which is that mail volumes are declining. Mail is just not as important as it used to be. The Congress won't allow them to make changes that would make them more put them on stronger financial footing, like charging more for mail, cutting back certain delivery that is unprofitable, and that sort of thing. And so the post office just doesn't have the money on hand to pay off this huge debt that it ran up. And so the way I look at this is, yes, the post office should have been prefunding this stuff all along. And furthermore, going forward, they should be prefunding what employees are earning,
right,
which they aren't quite putting enough money in to do that right now. But that's, you know, that basically the post office, even though it didn't make this payment, it'll spend about $2.5 billion this year actually paying the health care bills of its retirees. The amount that it should be putting toward that in order to be covering what employees are earning this year is only about $3 billion. So really the post office is short, but only by about $500 million. Uh-huh. This other $5 billion that they would pay on top of that is of the nature of paying off a debt that the post office ran up. And basically any way that we deal with the fact that the post office has what is now a $46 billion unfunded liability, because over the last few years they have put aside some money to actually fund this thing. Any option we have to deal with that involves taxpayers paying the bill. Like, for example, we could just privatize the post office today.
Right.
And we could say, well, the buyer has to take on this healthcare liability. Well, that's just going to reduce the sale price of the post office by $46 billion. And so really taxpayers
right.
are on the hook. Or we can do what Congress was nominally trying to do in 2006, which is basically you say, well, we're going to restructure the post office so that it generates profits, and then we're going to plow those profits back into funding that healthcare trust. Again, that's, you know, that's money that would have been available to finance the government that is instead going to pay for this healthcare. The only way to actually shed the liability is to renege on it and say, well, we're not going to provide retiree healthcare that we promised. But I don't think that would be wise. The federal government is not insolvent, so it can't argue that it can't afford to provide these
right.
promised health benefits to postal employees. So I think this, you know, the way Republicans talk about this is that, you know, well, this is a cost of doing business for the post office. And if the post office can't make this $5 billion payment, then that means the post office is insolvent. And the way Democrats talk about it is that they talk about it like prefunding is just completely unnecessary. And furthermore, there's been a misunderstanding of an accounting issue here where they're claiming that the post office is being forced to prefund 75 years worth of benefits, which
right.
is untrue. It's just a misreading of the way the actuarial accounting works. But anyway, the Democrats are saying this is a future expense that shouldn't be dealt with now. It should be dealt with later. Republicans are talking about it like it's a current expense. Really, it's a past period expense. This is a debt that we ran up over decades when the post office wasn't prefunding this stuff. And it's a debt like, you know, like U.S. Treasury bonds. It's just a debt of the federal government. And so it'll have to be dealt with through the government's general books. We can't squeeze the money out of current postal revenues because
right.
the post office is already troubled in so many other ways.
Right. They can't just suddenly become much more productive. Yeah.
Right. Or if they can suddenly become much more productive, then all that means is that the government has this valuable asset.
Right.
But, you know, diverting the revenues that come off that asset to pay off this debt doesn't mean that you avoided the cost of that debt.
Right. So one thing that occurs to me that you might do here is, so normally when you sell asset, well, and when companies buy each other, there's sort of a strict mm-hmm. limit on how much of the liability of the bought company that they can take on, sort of idea being so companies don't buy up tons of small, like, loss-laden companies to reduce their tax burden.
Right.
But when the government bought shares of Citi and AIG and GM, it exempted itself from this rule on the sensible grounds that, you know, we're not trying to reduce our tax burden, we're the government. But it seems like you could do a similar exemption if you wanted to privatize the post office, that that say, look, if you buy this company, you're going to have to take on the losses, but as a special benefit, we'll let you write it off on your taxes in the future. And that would effectively mean sort of the taxpayers are on the bill. But it might look better for it to just be sort of in the form of future taxes that you don't get rather than a direct bailout. I don't think it would be much different.
I suppose, again, this is just another way of structuring the fact that the taxpayers pay this cost. Now,
right.
What you're saying is basically that you can sell the post office and you can attach a valuable tax asset to it,
right,
that will allow the buyer to basically take a credit against some corporate income tax that he otherwise would have paid. And so if that tax asset is worth $5 billion, then someone will be willing to pay $5 billion more for the post office. But then all that means is that they will pay $5 billion less in corporate tax in future years.
Right.
It ends up being a wash, I think,
it's
necessarily.
The same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's just basically another way of saying that, you know, this $46 billion thing is a negative asset.
Right.
That is a negative asset of the federal government. We can attach it to whatever we want, and we can amortize it whatever way we want. One way or another, taxpayers are paying that bill. Now, I think there's an argument to be had about whether, you know, the post office is going to be insolvent one day on its current track. And what you do with this retiree health benefit trust and what you tell the post office about how much money it has to put in it, all that changes is when the post office becomes insolvent. The trend is the same either way. I think you can have an argument about whether the existence of this anvil hanging over the post office's head creates a valuable incentive for streamlining and for stopping doing things that are stupid and cost a lot of money. I'm not sure that creates a lot of value. I think the post office has actually been pretty good about shrinking its workforce and becoming more efficient. It now takes a lot fewer employees than it used to sort a given amount of mail. The main problem is that Congress imposes all sorts of restrictions on the post office, on how it can set postal rates and where it has to deliver and when. And so I think the post office, I think, actually, to tout my corporate cousin, there was a great Business Week cover piece on this about a year ago.
Sure.
And I think there are deep management culture problems at the post office where it's not innovative enough and it's not innovative like the post offices in a lot of European countries are. But I think the big message that the post office is too big and it costs too much money to do the things that it does, that's gotten through to management. And they're working on it to the extent that Congress will allow them to. But unfortunately, you know, nobody wants to say, well, we're going to have less frequent rural mail delivery or we'll start charging 60 or 70 cents for first class letter, which, by the way, would still be cheap compared to most countries.
Oh, sure. And compared to the private sector alternative, certainly. And it's worth noting just sort of the cross-country comparison here that it's easy to make this a very simple or left-right issue, but many European social democracies have privatized healthcare, postal service systems. Excuse me.
Right.
That Sweden privatized theirs. I believe German postal services is private. Is that right?
Yes, and they, in fact, they own DHL, they used to until it folded in the U.S. a few years ago. And the Swiss Post Office is privatized. The Swiss Post Office, if you pay them an extra fee, will scan all your mail for you and send it to you electronically, so you don't actually have to handle any physical mail.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
It's sort of. I think it was. Well, one question is, if you don't privatize it, that the government effectively has this huge supply of physical capital. And sort of, there seem to be a lot of things you can do with that. I think Matt Iglesias a few years ago proposed sort of doing universal daycare by just sort of they have daycare centers and post offices.
I don't know about that one. I think the well, I think probably the right thing to do with excess post offices is to sell them for the
perhaps,
most part.
Perhaps, yeah.
Are we going to train postal workers to provide that daycare? Was the idea not just the real estate, but the excess workforce that we have? Because I don't know how the postal workers would feel about that.
Right.
yeah. Should we talk about you didn't build that like everybody's been doing for the last month?
Yeah, no, it's fun. It's I mostly enjoyed it. I think we both wrote pieces about this, and mine was very clearly a, like, I have a philosophy degree, what do I do with that excuse. But and I think yours got at sort of the root of why people are so angry about this more centrally.
Well, what I find funny, and this is broadly about the entire last 4 years of the administration, that I feel like every commentator on the left has gotten very good at saying that, you know, if the president says something people didn't like it, he was quoted out of context, or he was misunderstood, or it's, you know, that people are lying about what he said. And whenever the administration fails on a policy matter, it's, you know, it was Congress's fault, or it was, you know, the president tried but was blocked by the political environment, or, you know, the economy inherited was terrible. And sometimes these excuses are correct. Certainly Congress has been extraordinarily obstructive, and there are valuable things the White House would have gotten done if Congress hadn't stood in the way. But it's become basically this reflex to sort of assume that when something goes wrong, it was somebody else's fault, and Obama can't possibly have screwed anything up himself. And I think this speech was, in fact, really bad, really ill-advised, and kind of obnoxious. It was the problem was really tonal. It wasn't – it's fine to say that the government did valuable things, and you should be grateful for that. And you should be willing to pay for them. Now, first of all, I think the president should say that to everybody. For some reason, he reserves that message just for the top 2% of taxpayers, even though we have this massive out-year budget gap. But I think it's a fine message to be delivering. But the sort of sarcasm of, you know, the president, you know, saying he's always struck when people say, well, you know, it must be because I was so smart. Well, a lot of people are smart. Like, you know, a lot of people's success does have in great measure to do with the fact that they were especially smart or especially hardworking, or they did something of value that nobody else had figured out to do. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of belittling that in the speech. And he was belittling the individual contribution to success in an effort to make the case that basically wealthy people don't really deserve the assets they hold, and so the government should be able to go ahead and tax more of them. And so I think it was just it was an obnoxious way to make the argument that he was trying to make. And I think it was really strangely ill-advised on the White House's part. I think they are usually actually a lot smarter than that and a lot more careful about the tone the president strikes. But I just thought it was a really bad speech.
Yeah, I mean, I think politically there's I forget who said this, but the unforced error seems to be saying you didn't build that and not you didn't build that alone. That, like, the difference between what he was saying and what Elizabeth Warren said seems to be that there's a – she sort of morphed it into this broader communitarian thing, and it was much less sarcastic and much more sort of, you've all achieved great things, but you're part of a community, et cetera. And I think that would be much less grating. I mean, I think this is another area with one thing I think sort of our policy discussions generally have a very hard time dealing with is things where factors are necessary but not sufficient. So, like, mm-hmm. And this is a great example in that, like, I think part of the reason there was such a vivid reaction to it was I think most people who get to that area did work extremely hard, and many of them are sort of smarter or have sort of or better educated and have all these advantages, but they all worked hard. Like the Google guys worked hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard to think of someone who's become a billionaire short of heirs, without that kind of effort. And so it becomes naughty to make the point that, that I think sort of a more subtle version of Obama's speech would have made, which is, you know, everyone should work as hard, in this area. But sort of there are plenty of people who've tried every bit as hard and have been every bit as smart and have fallen short. What was striking to me is that sort of, and I tried to get at this in the piece, that there's a school within sort of contemporary political philosophy that's straightforwardly of the view that sort of if you have resources not due to actual choices you've made, and so not due to the hardness of your work and then sort of just due to contingent factors about your life, that is ill-gotten and should be redistributed. And I don't think Obama was sort of making a claim that strong. I think it was more like sort of your claim against coercion is weakened by that factor. But that school is like the practical implications of that are very extreme.
Yes,
that sort of G.A. Cohen, the sort of I think the best expositor of this view, was sort of an avowed socialist, and his first book was a defense of the Marxist theory of history. And one of the enduring sort of critiques of this is actually from leftists is that it's straight up insulting. That Elizabeth Anderson wrote a really interesting article saying, you know, what are you going to do? Like mail people checks saying, I'm sorry, you're so stupid. Here's some smart people's money. it makes people victims who don't want to see themselves as victims. And I think that was another sort of problem with the speech in that people don't want to see themselves as people who would have been rich if the universe had been nicer to them. You know?
Yeah.
Like it's a debilitating sort of view of your own life outcomes to adopt.
Go ahead.
No, I was done.
Well, I also think that there's another way for people who don't make over $250,000 to look at the speech, which is that I think, you know, the same, everyone has some accomplishments that they're happy about, or most people
right.
do, and which they take a certain amount of personal credit for. I mean, you could have given a similar speech talking to parents about how, you know, well, yeah, maybe your children are great, but, you know, you sent them to a school that the state runs, and you got Head Start, and you could lay out all these other things that the government
right.
had done for you, and so really, you know, why do you get to take credit for how great your children are? And I think people would take tremendous umbrage at that.
Right.
Even though substantively there would be a case to be had there. I mean, the state does, sure. you know, do all sorts of things that help parents parent. And I think anybody who takes credit for something they've done could take umbrage at the president's at the way the president laid this out in the speech. And even though he's, you know, right now he's just calling for higher taxes on the rich, you're right that it justifies tremendous things. It doesn't justify taking, you know, redistributive taxation. It justifies the government taking away basically anything from anybody who
right.
didn't
right.
in this view earn it themselves.
No, I think that's exactly right. And in a way that gets at a part of this that I think part of the sentiment that he was expressing is one that you hear from a lot of left of center people that people really recoil strongly to against the idea that poor people are like leeches off the government. That this is I only graduated from college this past spring, and all my friends were very adamantly against the Clinton welfare reforms that happened when they were like six. And it was this and I think it's this view that sort of anything that treats government assistance as though it's sort of making the poor sort of leeches off the more successful is sort of an ugly view to reject it. And one way that you fight back against this is to say, you know, the reason we have governments basically is to help property owners protect their property. Like that's historically why these things exist. And there are tons of advantages that rich people get from the government as well. So you're not alone. But there's so many better ways of phrasing that. That like everyone loves a good speech against corporate welfare.
Well, I'm also it makes me very nervous generally when you have when you swing the pendulum too far on this case about, you know, the extent to which success is driven either by individual factors or by, you know, luck and other things like that. Because
right.
I think, and I think we saw this in the discussion over the last few years about unemployment benefits. I agree that extended unemployment benefits are not a significant driver of unemployment rates over the last few years. And that's because with five job seekers for every job opening, if one of those job seekers isn't that interested in taking the job because he'd rather just sit there and collect unemployment benefits, somebody else will take the job. In the aggregate, it doesn't really affect employment that much.
Right.
But I think there's been a tendency on the left to talk about this like it's insulting to suggest that somebody wouldn't look for work because they can collect unemployment benefits.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's not insulting. It's treating the unemployed as people who respond to incentives.
Exactly.
And also, I think that there's this sort of armchair liberal way of looking at that, saying that, you know, well, people want to work and people want to be self-sufficient. But, you know, that you can say that when you have the option to get a job that is fulfilling and fun. For a lot of these people, it's the option is between collecting unemployment and taking some low-wage job that sucks. And that, you know, it does not provide life fulfillment and pays more than unemployment benefits do, but not so much more that that's clearly valuable. And at the same time, these people also, to the extent they go back to work, are likely to be losing other valuable government benefits.
Right.
The sort of so-called poverty traps where, you know, you lose eligibility for Medicaid, or other means-tested benefits. So they're facing marginal tax rates that can exceed 75%. So they're not even keeping that much more of the extra money they're earning. It makes total sense that people would be discouraged from going back to work because of that. We still need people to go back to work. It's a bad thing if people, you know, decide, well, I can, you know, I might as well just collect benefits because it's really, the deal is only very marginally better if I work, and then I have to work in this way that is unpleasant. And actually, that's part of why I think an important part of having a fairly generous welfare state and being able to extend unemployment benefits to 99 weeks in a severe recession like this is that you need some sort of social stigma about collecting those benefits. You need people to feel like it's a bad thing to be on benefits so that they are motivated to go back to work even when the financial incentives there are not that strong. And I think that I worry about this, there becoming this popular conception that really, you know, it doesn't matter how generous the benefit state is and how difficult it is to stay on it. If people will just go back to work because they want to, I think that's a fallacy. And I think that we're in some very specific economic conditions right now that mean we don't need to worry about UI benefits. That doesn't mean we don't need to worry about this problem in the broad sense.
Right. Right. Yeah. And you see it outside of UI benefits. I wrote a post a week or two ago about this new Raj Chetty, annual size study about, the earned income tax credit. And so the way they determine which neighborhoods know more about it is by how many people are bunched at exactly the right amount of income.
Okay.
To maximize their benefit. And you can see where this is going, that I got some responses from sort of left of center people being like you're accusing the poor cheating on their taxes. I'm like, no, I'm not.
They're following the rules.
They're being smart about their taxes the way that sort of I think the sensible liberal position should be, you know, poor people should be able to maximize their tax returns too. To be egalitarian about that.
Right.
It's a weird thing, and it gets bound up in all these sort of cultural things about, and these weirdly paternalistic things where sort of if you like Jason Furman make an argument about how sort of it's nice that Walmart's there to provide a low cost alternative for poor people, you get these responses that, well, they shouldn't have to go to Walmart. Well, I mean, they're choosing to go to Walmart. They're people. They make these choices. There's a weird paternalistic, element that comes in directed at poor people that doesn't seem to fall cleanly from actual sort of egalitarian principles.
Yeah.
Well, we're at an hour, so we should probably call it a talk. But
okay. Well, that was fun. I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about house music.
That is sad.
Next time.
We can always dream.
Yes. Okay.
Well, it was a pleasure. Cheers.
Great. Thanks, Dylan.
Bye.